going to ask Joe Huffman to ask God's blessing upon our gathering.
Gracious God, our Father, do we thank you that this is all. Calvary is past. The Lord, that we might live in you. We just ask our blessing this morning, our Father, as we open up God's word together. Just pray that there will be true blessings to each one here. Thank you for this time we have together throughout the week.
To the conclusion of the whole matter, we have chapters 10, 11, and 12, but I am going to read the 12th chapter, and please follow along. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Brother, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw near, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them, while the sun or the light or the moon or the stars are not darkened, nor the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble, the strong men shall bow or bend themselves, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those that look out of the windows are darkened, and the doors shall be shut in the streets, when the sound of the grinding is low, and he shall rise up at the voice of the bird, and all the daughters of music shall be brought low. Also, when they shall be afraid of that which is high, and fear shall be in the way, the almond tree shall flourish, the grasshopper shall be a burden, and desire shall fail, because man goeth to his long home, and the mourners go about the streets, or ever the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed, and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads and like nails, fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given by one shepherd. And further by these, my son, be admonished. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. Now let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now our brother Bob will open up the portion, and it's 10, 11, and 12. And there's a difference between being righteous and gracious, and I want to be a little gracious this morning and give him just a few more minutes to open up the subject. And when the few minutes are up, I will kick him on the shins. And then Bob, our dear brother Carol, will give us some thoughts. And then again, we want to open up the way for us all to express ourselves. And again, I say, give your questions, face the men here on the platform. Just wait a minute, Bob, I'm not through. And
where did you get that?
And those of you who have a little ministry on your heart, maybe a few words, face your audience, and then we'll all get the good and gain out of it. Now, my dear brother, Robert.
Is that it?
Don't rob us.
Okay. What I would like to do, because there are a number here who have not even been at the class at all in our time together, to just quickly try to review the book a little bit before we get to the 10th chapter. We believe that the book was written by Solomon, and the purpose of his writing was to achieve or to find out what is the chief good in all of, among mankind. And he's writing this, I believe, in order to be a witness to the nations around him, to stir up their minds to realize that everything that they could possibly do to try to find the chief good would be of no value apart from God. He opens up the book by telling us something of the restlessness of life, and he illustrates this at the very beginning of the book. Unceasing change, and yet it's always the same. God will not allow us to look at creation and the things of creation and try to find the answer to life just by what happens in creation. He then tests all of the pleasures of life, and he finds that these are absolutely inadequate to do the job of finding out what is the chief good. We find that he then examines what seems to be to him the purpose of life. And using only human wisdom, he finds that he cannot come up with an answer to the purpose of life by using wisdom or works or whatever. But his first conclusion is found in chapter 2, and this is very important, where he six times we find this same refrain being repeated throughout the book, that there is not a good in, this is 2:24 to 26, there is not a good inherent in man that he should be able to eat and drink and get satisfaction from his work. He says, even this I realized was from the heart of God, or from the hand of God. Apart from him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? For to the man who pleases him, he gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and heaping up in order to give it to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and chasing after wind. And he's saying by this that even though man, apart from God, can try his very best to find enjoyment, even through the simple things of eating and drinking and finding satisfaction from his work, he found out that the only way one can get this satisfaction and enjoyment is from the hand of God. That is to say, he must fear God. He must put his faith and trust in God and then obey his commandments. And then he's going to be able to enjoy life. He says you cannot enjoy life apart from that. Now, Then we find that later on in the next section, chapter 3, that there is an all-encompassing plan that God has for all mankind. That's why there was a time and a season for everything. And the principle was that God has a plan which embraces every man and woman and all their actions in all times. And the idea is to try to find out what that plan is, and then to come in contact with the plan, to bring myself into obedience to that plan. But as he examines life, he finds that there are a lot of apparent contradictions all throughout life, which seem to come as the result of the providence of God. Things that we cannot explain. And he says, I know that I can't explain it, and you know that you can't explain it. But even so, in spite of all of this, that God is still on his throne, and God is working out the best for man, and that we should fear God, we should be able to eat and drink and enjoy life because we receive it as a gift from God. In spite of these anomalies, we know that God's plan is going to work out. He's very strong here in this area on the sovereignty of God. Then we find in chapter 5 that there were certain implications, that there were certain causes and warnings which must be raised, lest someone come to a hasty conclusion that would lead him to deny the reality and the existence of God's providence and plan. You see, when things don't go well, we say, well, God doesn't know what he's doing. He's not fair. And Solomon says, I know there are a lot of things we don't understand, but God is nonetheless very fair. Then we find that in chapter 6 and 7, he's going to evaluate man's riches and ability to gain these things. And then the sufferings of man and the enigma that those sufferings are to people that have to go through them. And he says, prosperity is not always or necessarily good in chapter 6. And then he says that adversity and affliction is not always or necessarily evil in chapter 7. That is to say that God brings these things, these afflictions, in order for us to realize that we are insufficient of ourselves. And then the last section begins, in my thinking, with chapter 8. And we have in that section the removing of discouragements and applying God's plan to the lives of believers. There is a remaining mystery that man can never understand in God's good plan, and that's the matter of sin and death. Why does he allow sin and death? But Solomon says that's beyond our ability to understand. Let's not allow this remaining mystery to diminish human joy. Let's not allow this remaining mystery to prevent us from working with all our might, you see. And so that brings us to our portion today, for that takes us through the 9th chapter and through part of the 10th. Now let's begin with that this morning. And if you turn to chapter 10, we're going to follow through on this. He starts out the first verse, dead flies or flies of death cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. And this is really an illustration of the previous verse, that wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. He's really suggesting here that a little bit of folly ruins the one who has a reputation of wisdom and honor. We've had happen in our area of the country not too long ago a situation where we've had a man among us who was highly revered as far as his understanding of the Word of God, his ability to communicate this, all of these things, and he made a really bad decision in his life. It was just a little bit of folly. But I think it's caused the ruin, at this point at least, the whole man's life for God from this point on. A little folly ruins somebody who has a reputation for wisdom and honor. We have to be careful about how we live. This tells us some of the results of foolish and wise works. This is what Solomon is talking about in this chapter. And then he contrasts them. This chapter is a reinforcement about the value of wisdom, which is better than folly. For instance, he says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. He's not talking about right hand and left handed here as such, except to say that the right hand is that which defends and that which supports. And in the idea of the Bible, the left hand was that which was sinister or that which was possibly underhanded. That's where we get our word sinister from. The word sinister in Latin means left-handed, would you believe? That's too bad about you folks that are left-handed. I feel sorry for you. But a fool's heart and mind are useless to him in emergencies. His fool's heart is at his left. Verse 3, he talks about the lifestyle. He says, yea, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. That is to say that his very lifestyle proclaims to all that he's a fool. He's a fool. Verses 4 to 7, we have the wisdom of patiently submitting to the anger of tyrannical rulers. And we find this because of what is recorded in chapter 8 and verses 16 and 17. Men are not always able to tell why certain things are done, and therefore they need to submit to them, knowing that possibly God is using that in their life. Wisdom in verse 4 there, if the spirit of a ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth a great offensive. That's sort of a correspondence to the word in Matthew, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Then in verses 5 and 6 he talks about the folly of playing favorites, of despotism and of nepotism, of hiring your favorites and causing great problems, when really the leaders, these are leaders without wisdom, and he's saying that the proper leader should be brought into power. And then the verses that may be a little bit of an anomaly here are verses 8 to 11. He diggeth a pit, he that diggeth a pit shall fall into it. Whoso breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. And you have five or six different things spoken of here, which are really the contrasting results of the application of wisdom and folly. The person who is wise will dig a pit, but he'll be careful that he doesn't fall into it. The person that's full of folly will dig a pit and fall into that pit. And each one of these things that's spoken of in verses 8 and 11 through 11, show us the value of wisdom over folly. Then in verses 12, he talks about the 12 through 15. He talks about the learned man, of how he's cautious with his words. But the fool proves his folly by his words. All he's got to do is open his mouth, you know. And it's very obvious that he's a fool just by what he says, by his actions, by his words, by his attitudes. Verses 16 to 20, we have the use of wisdom in a fresh effort to aid men in the happy improvement in their lives. Those kings and nobles, he says, are fools who indulge in luxury and intemperance and allow the country to deteriorate and to permit abuses to flourish, such as what you had in the life of Idi Amin. Then in chapter 11, dropping down, we have sort of what I would consider an active involvement as far as the individual is concerned. and that it's proper that that person should get involved in sharing his life and all of his things with others, even when success is not guaranteed. We're often the kind of person that likes to do nice things if we're pretty sure we're going to get some kind of good things in return. But he says, cast your bread upon the waters, and perhaps it'll come back. At least if it doesn't come back to you, somebody will be helped by it. He goes on to say in chapter 11, give a portion to seven or also to eight, because you don't know what evil shall be upon the earth. You may not get it back, but then again you might get it back. It might come back to you in equal amounts. But even if it doesn't, think of the enjoyment you get with sharing with as many as possible. He's saying that the person who wants to know the certainty of everything before he begins it will never accomplish anything of value. If the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth, and so forth. Verse 4 says, he that observeth the wind shall not sow. He wants to be sure the wind's just in the right direction or not blowing at all, or he's not going to sow. He that regardeth the cloud shall not reap. And he doesn't mean that we shouldn't be prudent in the way we do things, but if we want to have certain answers to everything, certain success before we start, we'll never accomplish anything. This is sort of the if idea. If I had this, or if I had that, or if this had happened, or if so-and-so had done this, then look what I could have done. This is an iffy portion right here, is it not? So, in verses 1 to 6 of chapter 11, he deals with those who are above us, below us, those who need help from us. The previous verses of chapter 10 are those where he deals with those above us. In chapter 11, he deals with those who are below us, you see. And then Solomon lists a half a dozen incidents to describe how we should be diligent in helping others, even though we cannot be assured of this success, as we've been mentioning. Now, going on to, I don't want to take a lot of time in this. Verses 7 to 10, he tells us to enjoy the present and look forward to the future. And notice how he puts this to the young man. This is one of the strong conclusions of this chapter. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart. Someone has said that's a bad statement there, but he's suggesting that as he has been reading this book, or as you have been reading this book and find that God is the answer, this is what he means by walking in the ways of thine heart. He's not suggesting that a man should just live any way he pleases. To walk in the ways of thine heart, in the sight of thine eyes, but know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Be careful how you live. Enjoy life. Recognize that fearing God is the answer, and that he is the one that can give you that enjoyment. And be always cautious, because God's going to bring everything you do into judgment. And if you're aware of this, then you're going to walk in the proper ways. Therefore, remove sorrow from thy heart. Put away evil from thy flesh. For childhood and youth are transitory. Enjoy that youth, but enjoy it in the proper way, with putting God first in your life. And then he goes on to talk to that youth. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, because life is transitory. Your youth is going to leave you very quickly. If you live in the youth for yourself and only for yourself, you're going to rue the day that it ever happened. I appreciated very much Ed Besselman's testimony and telling us some of the things that he went through. I'm sure if he could go back to the beginning without all of these other things, he would say, this is where it starts. This is where we would like to have started it, instead of the way it did start. We thank God for bringing him back. But it's an illustration of one at the time who tried to find out the answer to life apart from God. And it just isn't there. Now, when he gets to verses 3 to 7, 3 to 6. We have what I consider to be an allegory of what it means to grow old. I'm sure most of you, including me, will identify with this quite good. There are 17 features here, and let me go through them quickly. The keepers of the house tremble. That's the arms and hands with palsy and that kind of thing. The strong men are bent. Speaks about the legs being bent and the knees tottering. The grinders cease. The teeth lose their ability to chew, or the teeth just are like stars. They come out at night. Those looking out speak about the eyes losing sight and the pupils being contracted. The doors being shut in the street talks about the lips falling into the mouth because of lack of teeth. You've seen that situation, haven't you? The sound of grinding is low. Here there's hearing loss. Here there's also having to eat soft food because you can't chew your food. You can't chew into a tough steak anymore because the teeth have been ground down. So the sound of the grinding is low, you see. One rises up at the voice of the bird. And how I realize at my age, which isn't really old at all, that I can't sleep till 12 o'clock. I couldn't do that if I wanted to. I could as a kid. I could lay down and I could sleep to get to bed at 11 o'clock and sleep till 12 o'clock the next day. I can't do that anymore. And the older you get, the more you find that your sleep is a much shorter time. He even rises, he's awake at the voice of the bird in the morning. The daughters of music suggest the qualities to make and to enjoy music, which are not there. They don't have the ability to do that. My own mother-in-law, who is an octogenarian at this point, and who is a very fine musician, cannot sing the hymns anymore, for she's just lost her voice to sing. It isn't there. It's missing. She loves the hymns. There isn't any woman I know that loves hymns more than my mother-in-law. She can't even sing them. She plays them beautifully on the piano. You see where my wife gets it, for one thing. But she can't sing them because the daughters of music are missing. They're afraid of high places. It talks about the almond tree blossoming, the hair turning white. I remember a number of years ago, this goes back to 65 when I was quite a bit younger, and my brother's only 3 years older than me, and he was already white. And he was introducing me as the speaker for his Bible class at Bell Telephone, Ma Bell, in Philadelphia, which he's had for about 20 years. And he introduced me and said, now we're going to have my brother speak to you from the Word of God. And I got up and said, I'm sorry, fellas, but he's really my father. See, my father's name is Harold, you see. The almond trees blossom, the hair turns white, the grasshopper drags, there's the halting gait of the elderly, the caperberry fails, all sexual power and desire is lost. Man goes to his eternal home, and of course that's very obvious. The mourners are in the street. The silver cord snapped, the suggest of the spinal cord paling and eventually breaking. The golden bowl broken. Some suggest that this is the brain, even suggest its shape and its color. The pitcher broken at the fountain. The failing heart is pierced and no longer can do the job of pumping. The wheel broken at the cistern suggests the circulatory system of veins and arteries. All of these things happen as the older we get. And then he says the body is made of earth and returns to earth. And with this we find in verse 8 the preacher is done. And then he comes to the conclusions. He says that there still is a wisdom that's valuable. And I'm going to share that with you. He said I'm going to teach these things to you. But the total conclusion of the whole thing is fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. The only answer to the enjoyment of life is in putting your trust in God and in obeying His Word. Isn't that still true today? That hasn't changed, even with the progressive knowledge of the New Testament. And then he puts the word of warning, God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. I want to read you a little poem, and with this I'm going to stop, which was in Sidlow Baxter's book on Ecclesiastes, which is a rather grim little poem entitled Sympathetic Lines of a Father to a Daughter in Bed with Mumps. Okay? From which we're going to cull the following wistfully philosophical rhymes. Listen to this. Thus generations come and go, from youth to age they wiser grow. Yet as they pass they all relate, they learned their lessons just too late. Our junior wisecracks dodge the truth that dense old parents once were youth, that present youth must older grow, oft haunted by, I told you so, and all their youthful bombast rue when they as parents suffer too. When they as parents suffer too, as with strange certainty they do, they marvel at the self-sure ways the next relay of youth displays. They hear the same old arguments arrayed in fresh accoutrements. The times are different, so are we. Just let us have our way and see, for artful nature oft repays her rebels in ironic ways. Thus generations as they go perpetuate the tale of woe. They will not learn from yesterday, but choose to learn the harder way. Experience shall be teacher, please, and well he teaches. But what fees? What fees he charges those he schools before he makes wise men of fools? How oft his scholars have confessed, ah yes, poor dad and mum knew best. Each generation soon is past, so sure at first, so sad at last. As ranks of youth's successive rise, each thinks we are supremely wise. They each a lot more knowledge know, and yet a bit less wisdom show. O sanguine youth, God's word revere. Honor your parents while they're here, and you will find in later days what handsome dividends it pays.
Mm-hmm. Brother Bob, you've carried the explanation very beautifully, and I think it has been opened up well to us. But my dear brethren and sisters, don't take all that he said about left-handers. He only gave you a little bit about them. There were 700 men in the tribe of Benjamin, left-handed. They could sling a stone to a hair's breadth. And you be careful of left-handers. They're very accurate. I was boasting about this from the platform here one day when we had Henry Armading here, and I thought that I had the last word. Yes, but he said when the Lord wanted to have a giant killed, he had to take a right-handed man, David. So I was deflated even in the end. I should have held that back, I guess. I had felt like I was a little more on the top.
What do you do when you're both left-handed and right-handed?
You're very dexterous.
Oh, I see. Okay. Amory. Okay. Well, I'm going to just touch on a few of the verses that he talked about and maybe add a thought or two. In that first verse of the 10th chapter. I think that's very important. It says when a fly falls into the perfume and or caused the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor, when it falls in there and dies. And he pointed out the fact that when a person who has built up, spent a lifetime perhaps building a good reputation, makes one mistake, they can ruin that reputation. And I too have experienced what he said with a man who was an elder in the assembly, made one mistake, but it ruined him as far as his service in that assembly is concerned. But there's one thing that I wanted to add to that, and that is that you and I need to be very careful that we don't add to that ruin unnecessarily. I often think of what that lady said. I never say anything about anybody unless it's good, and boy, is this good. You know, all of us love to have a little bit of choice gossip. And you know, it's very good advice concerning this, that when we hear something, you know, newspapers constantly destroy the character of individuals on page one and retract it on page 46 down in the corner. And we need to be very careful, because once it's out, people never again believe that it wasn't true, even though it really was not true. So you and I want to be very careful, I think, concerning that. And we want to be careful as individuals to see that we do build a reputation as Christians that looks like a Christian. I've told sometimes about the little boy whose father was telling him something about a Christian, and the little boy said to his father, said, "Daddy, have I ever seen a Christian?" And many times in our individual lives, our life is such that we don't even have that reputation. So let's build a reputation. Let's see that we don't do something to destroy the reputation of ourselves, and see we don't help in the destroying of the reputation of others. And then in verse 4, I wanted to mention, it says, "If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses." You know, sometimes your boss or your ruler, I would like to apply it to the fact of our boss, perhaps where we work, he makes us mad, and sometimes we quit. You know, we just get mad and blow our stack and quit the job, maybe. But you know, if we learn to accept that submissively, even though he may be wrong and we may be right, I try to teach my children to accept this submissively. And in the end, the thing will work out. It'll pacify the individual if you accept it submissively. I often say it's very hard for somebody to hit you in the mouth when you're smiling at them, you know, and if you just submissively accept this, later on there may something come up where you really deserve to be bawled out, and he won't do anything about it. And that's good advice. And then the other thing is, I used to tell my children, besides that, it'll drive them mad if you submit submissively when they're bawling you out. So that's a little selfish part to it. But it is to your advice. I mean, to your advantage, I should say, to do it. And then in verse 14 it says, "A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell it?" And it's true oftentimes that a fool talks and talks and talks and doesn't say anything. My father, in speaking about this, told about the man who wanted a divorce from his wife. And when asked by the judge why, he said, "Because she just talks and talks and talks and talks." And the judge says, "Well, what did she talk about?" He said, "She don't say." Well, that's what this verse is saying, that we talk and talk and talk and we don't say anything. You know, and oftentimes those that talk the least really have the most to say. But a lot of us talk just to bridge the gap so that somebody else won't talk, I believe. At any rate, it says that you don't know what's going to be. You don't know the things, and so you're best not to talk unless you do know, and it'll be to your benefit and to the benefit of others. In verse 16, it speaks of the fact that we need to pity that country whose leaders are immature and easily led as a child, and where the Congress, in our case, carouses and lives it up instead of attending to business. And certainly that is the problem in our nation today. And Solomon could have been writing that today about the United States. And you and I need to pray particularly for our leaders in this day, that God would give us leaders who care about our country. And we find we have leaders who, instead of that, do not seem to care. And then in the next portion in chapter 11, we see where it says, let's see, verse 2, give a portion to 7 and to also to 8, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. And I believe that that suggests liberal giving. Our brother mentioned that it's giving, but I think it suggests liberal giving. God, we're to give as God has given us, not a tenth, but what God has given us. Perhaps we can afford to give 80% or 90% some months, and we're to give as God has given us. You know, many of us save for a rainy day. We say, well, we may need it down the road. But the whole indication of Scripture and the indication here is that that's very unwise for the individual from a natural point of view, and it's certainly unwise from God's point of view. God intends for His people to be channels, not dams. When you have your money in the bank, it's of no value to anybody except the banker. He's making plenty of money off of it, but it's of no value to you. And that doesn't mean you should be foolish, but I would certainly encourage God's people to give. And we're not to try and plan our kindness. We're not to say, somebody one time said to me, I'd like to give something to that person. Said, I'd like for you to go and find out if they really need it. Well, that's not the kind of giving. God, you know, tell them, now I'm going to give you this, but use it only for groceries or something. That's not your responsibility. Your responsibility is to give. And God will hold the receiver responsible for how they use it. That's not your responsibility. Once you give it, don't worry about how they use it. If they show up next week with a new car, that's none of your business whatsoever. That's the business of the individual. If they were wrong in doing it, God will hold them responsible. You don't have to worry about it. We'll bless. If you don't give when you can, the time will come when you can't give. That's what showed here. You know, and if you don't trust God for your needs, if you trust your money in the bank, God will let you depend on the money in the bank. And if you trust God, God will let you depend on Him. My father tells of years ago, in the case of his family, my grandfather was trying to decide whether he should insure their home. It was worth a lot of money in those days. It had been the estate of a ruler in that country. And my grandfather had 23 people living with him, so he needed a big house, and he bought this. But anyway, the insurance in that day was $1,200, and this goes back to about 1890 or something like that, somewhere in there. So he said to my grandmother, he said, what do you think? Should I go ahead and buy this insurance? And she said, no, why don't you give it to the Lord? And she mentioned two things that they had heard about that were needs, and he thought about it, and he bought the insurance.
And 9 months later, the building burned to the ground. And he said to my grandmother, he said, "See, if I'd have listened to you, we'd have lost everything." She said, "If you'd have listened to me, there wouldn't have been a fire." You see, you and I need to trust God. And if we trust him, we can rest upon his promise. Give to 7 or 8. Give to all needs as able. In hard times, we should give more if we're able. Help the young couples in your assembly. Help the young men and young women that are going on for the Lord. Use your money while you can for God, and he'll bless it to you in the days to come. In verse 5, it says, "As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow," and so forth. He says that you and I often have to work in the dark. We have to work by faith as Christians. We don't know which way the wind's going to blow. We don't know how a baby is formed in a pregnant woman. The doctors still don't know that. They can tell you the steps, but they don't know how it works. And he says, you're not going to understand all that God does either, but you can accept it all by faith. Well, there's a lot more we could say, but that's probably my time, so I'll quit.
Now we trust that there has been enough given that will encourage you to ask questions and also to give a little ministry as you face the audience. And we trust that the Spirit will not in any way be hindered from moving the next 20 minutes or so. This is the conclusion of the whole matter, and we ought to have something to ask or to give. Nobody has held up their hands thus far, but a dear sister came to me last night and she said, "Please give some exposition on the 7th verse of the 12th chapter." We often say, and I've read tracts, that a man or a woman or a sinner 5 minutes after he dies is in hell. And this is what she had in her mind, I think. And the verse says, "Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the Spirit shall return unto God who gave it." Now, if the Spirit returns unto God who gave it, then the person isn't in hell. Now, that was her viewpoint. That is, if they were sinners. I see you looking at me, Robert.
I guess I shouldn't look.
Maybe you would like to. I'll catch you in a moment. Just a moment.
Just to say this, it seems to me that what he's really saying is that it returns to God for disposition.
Yes.
In other words, the judgment of God, he talks about that God shall bring every work into judgment and every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And if the spirit's evil, that is to say, if it's not a believing spirit, obviously it'll go to a lost eternity. Mm-hmm. And if it's a believing spirit, it'll stay in the presence of God. I don't think the idea is, I think what he's really trying to tell us here is that where he said that the dead know nothing in a previous verse, and where the dead, that's the end of everything, he's saying that from the standpoint of the view of mankind upon this earth without any revelation from God. And this is really part of his revelation from God, that it does return to God, and God disposes of the spirit to place it where it belongs according to whether it was fearing God in life or whether it didn't.
Very good answer, I think. The revelation that we have of truth is only partial in Ecclesiastes, and it's quite partial, isn't it? This dear brother.
Possibly it could also be the part of man which the Lord breathed into Adam that created a living soul. Whereas you still have the spirit returning back to God, you have the body going to the ground, and you have the soul there for judgment.
Yes. Good thought.
You could still have the spirit that God gave going back to the to God, and then the soul being there for judgment.
Mm-hmm. Good God. Brother, rise up with your hand. That's your hand. You had brother Dunkerton. See how we get an enlarged view of things if two or three brethren open it up? It's beautiful. Are there any other thoughts connected with this verse?
If you suggest that the Spirit just returns to God and stays with God, then that which is especially the part of man which is in the image of God would no longer be there, either for the believer or the unbeliever. See, the Spirit, God is a Spirit. We are made in that image. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that which will be judged will be the entire limit of man. His body, soul, and spirit are going to be put together at the great white throne and cast into the lake of fire. So that which was of the image of man and was completely marred will be that which will suffer. The fact that if you take his spirit away, then he has no ability to know that there's a God that exists. I believe one of the worst terrors of hell will be the fact that man knew God, would glorify him not as God, turned his back on God, and will rue the day that he didn't have the opportunity or didn't take the opportunity to receive him into his heart.
Brother,
if you note that I said that you, when you saw a need, you would give. Whether they used it for that need is their responsibility. That was what I said.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with you. I would not give money to somebody that I knew would use it for something other than a need.
Now I think we've answered this lady's question quite well. There ought to be some other subjects here that ought to be brought before us, I believe. Don't you appreciate verse 11? Our brother was just speaking back there of having some of the words of the wise, and I understand from what he said that he has some wisdom. Well, the words of the wise are like goads and like nails. Those goads are like something like a left-hander. He's very accurate. And
are you left-handed, Charlie?
Oh, no. And like nails, and fastened by the master of assemblies, which are given by one shepherd. I often think of ministry. that comes down from the head. And we've been learning that all the fullness of the Godhead bodily dwells in our head, and which is Christ, of fine gold, a ministry that comes down from him into his body. We're bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. And when ministry like that comes down into the body, what a blessing it is. It's not one of those pickled kind that you get out of a jar, you know. They are actually alive and real. And what a blessing it is to our souls. Someone have a hand up? I thought, Dawn, you were smiling. I thought you had your hand up. Brother Paul has a thought following you. You go ahead.
Someone has said, maybe, Lord, I can show someone else what I've been through on my way to you. Here, the wisest man in all the earth, what was his own thought in life? He majored on the minors when he should have listened to his dad. And who was his dad? David the king.
Yeah.
David said in Psalm 27 verse 4, one thing have I desired of the Lord that I will seek after, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple.
Beautiful. Brother Paul, you had...
I was only thinking of the humor that you were exposing up there on the left hand.
Oh, give it, please, if it's something on...
Really, those men were left hand.
Oh.
That set him back 20 years.
That's true.
They could bat with either hand.
They couldn't use the right hand properly. That's correct. That's what the Hebrew says, yes.
Well, I'm sure that I can't use my right hand properly. I just can't. I just can't.
The word dexterous means right.
Right.
And sinister means left.
Well, I guess I'm pretty well deflated by now. So I think we ought to get on to another subject. Brother?
What?
When you gentlemen were talking on verse 10, or chapter 10, verse 1, dead flies cause the ointment of the perfumer to send forth an evil odor. And you mentioned that, you know, it's the job of a Christian in order to, you know, walk right, to keep his testimony up. I thought to turn to 1 Corinthians 9:27, where Paul says, but I keep my body. But I keep under my body and bring it under submission, lest by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway.
Disapproved.
What he was saying,
yeah,
here was, I have to keep my life in order because I'm in the public eye. And if I do one thing wrong, somebody's going to say to me, well, Paul's testimony isn't any good anymore. We're going to have to disqualify himself. And he didn't want that to happen.
Yeah. Very good.
Very good. And it seems as though Satan is very active too in this. It's maybe not only the lust of the flesh that strikes one, but Satan is very active, I think, with his darts in and with those who are in the public, who are witnessing publicly for the Lord.
Could I say something about the 9th and 10th verses of that 12th chapter? It says, he had just got finished repeating again that everything was vanity, and he says, moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words that were written, that which was written was upright, even words of truth. And not only was he wise, but he sought to share the wisdom. And he didn't share it with long, hard stories. You know, sometimes when I read commentaries, Bible commentaries, you know, you got to read 48 pages to get a one-sentence thought. These people put these multitude of words. But he says that he did it with short proverbs, thought out, easily understood, making sure that they were accurate. It says he chose his words carefully to try to make it comforting and pleasant and understandable and yet true, so that the people could learn. He used what in the sales business we call the KISS method, keep it simple, stupid. You know, you want to make it understandable. And I believe that that's the gift that God gives to individuals. For instance, if I have the gift of preaching, the gift is not the knowledge of the Word. The gift is my ability to take that knowledge and make it understandable to you. That's the gift. Every Christian can have the same or better knowledge of the Word than the greatest preacher alive by simply studying the Word with the help of the Holy Spirit. They can have the knowledge, but the ability to take those thoughts and make them understandable to the others is the gift. And that's what he's saying. The preacher here is giving it to you in simple, concise ways so that you can understand. And as you read it, you can see how those things are true. The simple things, you know, we need interpretation on some of them because he wrote for that day. But even today, you can look at them and see what he means concerning each of these things. And it's good thought for us to do as well. Keep it simple.
If you think you have the gift of teaching, you better find a lot of people that have the gift of listening.
Brother Jim.
A little louder,
Jim. We can't hear you. Every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it will be evil, God will bring it out. That's beautiful. Pardon me, Brother Williams. I hope you haven't wiped the smile off of my face, dear brethren, in jabbing the left-handers. All right, brother. Our time is exhausted. In fact, we've gone a little bit over. Brother Bill, give us the announcement.